Hello, I'm Valerie Jackson, and this evening, guest host Lois Reitzes will be going between the lines with Kathleen Shine, talking about her latest book of fiction, The Three Weissmans of Westport. Here's Lois with Kathleen Shine.
Thank you very much for going between the lines. When I read the New York Times review of The Three Weissmans, I tried to imagine your reaction to the piece. It seemed like the sort of response an author would dream of, if not write for oneself. You have reviewed many books by other people. How did you feel when you read that Times review?
I cried, actually. I could not believe what I was reading. It was so generous and so gracious. And I was really flabbergasted and very, very thrilled and grateful. I stopped a long time ago reviewing books that I don't really love. Mm-hmm. I don't feel, you know, because I've gotten reviews, I don't have the stomach for it. Unless once in a while, if someone is terribly famous and kind of overrated, maybe I would consider it. But usually I really only review things I just love. I recognized a review that, you know, that it felt real to me, and yet I couldn't believe it. It was a very, very exciting moment. Plus, to see it on the cover, yeah. I mean, I never, you know, I was thrilled.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
You take Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility as inspiration for The Three Weissmans. Why does Jane Austen's influence seem inexhaustible?
That's a good question. I don't really know. I think it started, this wave of it started with the movie Clueless, which really was a wonderful movie. I mean, I think in general, her characters are so, the family relationships are so funny and so real. I think people respond to that, in a visceral, immediate way. And at the same time, the plots are very, you know, very, very engaging. But you could say that about other writers as well. And there isn't the same number of books that have been devoted to what one early 20th century critic referred to as Austenology. For me, the reason what happened to me with this was I was reading Sense and Sensibility. I'd read it many, many times before, and I reread books a lot, and this was one of them. And I finished it this time. I was lying in bed, and I was thinking, what is it about this book that feels so familiar and so immediate, because basically it's a book, the premise of which is all based on a 19th century law that never existed in the United States and certainly doesn't exist even in England now, which is primogeniture, which was the law of inheritance when the oldest male heir of an estate would inherit. And the women, the wife, the daughters, would be completely cut off. And I was thinking about it, and I thought something about this just is striking me as so familiar. What is it? And it suddenly hit me, the answer was divorce. That is a kind of modern iteration of this economic as well as emotional frailty that we see in the 19th century novels about women, in which marriage is very much part of the economic machinery of the society.
Mm-hmm. Betty, the mother, is a wonderful character. She's an elegant woman accustomed to living in luxury, a beautiful Central Park West apartment. She wears Chanel suits. And yet, it's clear that nothing is more important to her than her role in the family. She's a very loving mother, and she had been a loving wife. Then suddenly, one day, her husband tells her he's leaving her. I was going to ask if you would read the first two paragraphs of the book.
Well, I can kind of paraphrase them. I mean,
Please.
he tells her, well, first of all, when Joseph Weissman left his wife, he was 78 and she was 75. And he explains to her, they've been married for 48 years, and he explains to her that it's because of irreconcilable differences. And she looks at him kind of confused and says, irreconcilable differences? Of course there are irreconcilable differences. What does that have to do with divorce? And in writing this book and the book having a kind of ongoing relationship with Sense and Sensibility, you know, as I wrote it, I felt that. You know, part of what you want to do when you have that kind of dialogue with a great work like Sense and Sensibility is you want to both honor it and also transform it. And one of the ways that The Three Weissmans of Westport is very different from one of the many ways is including, I mean, all proportions kept, we're talking about Jane Austen, the greatest novelist of comedies of manners ever. But one of the ways in which it's different is that I found myself much more interested in the mother of the two women than Jane Austen was in the mother of her two girls in Sense and Sensibility. In fact, I just found myself completely falling in love with Betty, and she became a much larger character than I had anticipated at first.
She is very lovable. She's devastated, but not really as bitter as she could be. You have her kind of catching up on 21st century phenomena like daytime television and all sorts of products that she's never been acquainted with before. She's forced into exile to the family cottage in Westport, Connecticut, and then for their own compelling reasons, her daughters join her in living there. Sense and Sensibility contrasts passion and restraint as embodied by the two sisters. How do you go about updating these questions of courtship and the sisters' lives as they pertain to the present?
Well, for one thing, I found myself much more interested in and have, as the years have gone on, much more interested in the lives and loves of the middle-aged rather than the young. And I really wanted to write a book that looked at mature people falling in love. Because when you think about it, a young person, when you're in your 20s, you have 20 or so years of history behind you, and it's very powerful. But when you're 50, you've had a whole lifetime, probably two lifetimes, of history that you've lived and of experience. And I feel that when people of that age fall in love, I kind of imagine it as if they have these huge, long, flapping tails behind them of their experience and history. And when two of them get together, those tails start banging into each other and all kinds of things happen. And that was something I wanted to write about people who already had children, grown children, falling in love. People who had careers and mistakes and all kinds of critical things that had happened to them falling in love. So that was one way, I think, that it was, if not modernized. It was tampered with to kind of fit my interests and what fascinates me right at the moment. I gave the younger daughter I made into a rather fabulous literary agent who handles a lot of memoir writers, and the memoirs are the kind of very lurid memoirs that we sometimes see, and the crisis that befalls her is that all of her biggest names are suddenly revealed to have been completely falsifying all their lurid adventures, and that in fact they're quite ordinary people who haven't done much at all. And the other daughter is a director of a small library, and is a very serious sort who in some ways identifies more with the books on the shelves than with the people around her.
You talked about being more interested in mature love and people who bring much more life experience to matters of love. I thought that it was particularly poignant when you wrote about the women who came to an author's reading. You said they were an identifiable class of citizens, America's lost souls, like the lost boys of Africa. But they weren't boys. They were women, older women, still beautiful in their older way, still vibrant in their older way with their beauty and vibrancy, suddenly accosted by one thing beauty and vibrancy cannot withstand. Irrelevance. I was going to ask, I would think that's the sort of writing that would result in your getting thank you notes from women readers.
I think a lot of women responded to that. And I do feel that very strongly, not just about, I mean, I'm 57, so I'm up there. But, you know, I'm very close to my mother and a lot of her friends. And I've seen women over the, certainly of my mother's generation over the past, say, 30 years. And I've seen divorces and what happens. And it's a lot of women find a way to reinvent their lives, and it's wonderful. And other women never really recover. And it felt very poignant to me. And I wanted, in some ways, to honor all of those women and women in general. The other thing is, this book is very much about mothers, mm-hmm. And motherhood, and. I mean, when some comedian said that being in a family is like a life sentence for a crime you didn't commit. and it's in some ways it's true. It's one of the reasons that I love writing about families. You have these very, very different personalities all jumbled up in this institution that none of them chose to join. And so it allows for a lot of comedy and a lot of drama and tragedy and for me it's a lot of fun to write about. But there's also one of the things I found myself very interested in the idea of these two grown women moving into a house with their older mother. And, you know, that's three people who are used to their own households and trying suddenly to sort of reconstitute this family. And so the way that they all bump into each other and bump up against each other, I found very, you know, sisters, and the way they harbor grudges from so many years ago. And the poor mother, you know, she thinks she's going into this little cottage for, kind of sanctuary, and her daughters are coming to help her through this terrible time. And she ends up making tuna fish sandwiches for them all the
and
time.
And shushing them when they fight.
Right. And, they completely turn back into children, and she turns back into mommy. And in a way, that's invigorating, but in another way, it's exhausting. So that was a lot that I found that very, I found that a very rich environment to write about.
Do you have siblings?
I have a younger brother, and I have, by the way, spent many summers when my children were little. I would go to my mother's house in Connecticut and spend 3 months there, and it was great. I mean, the first 10 days were spent fighting over how to load the dishwasher, but after we sort of established our female territory, then it was really quite wonderful.
If you're just joining me, I'm going between the lines with Kathleen Shine, author of The Three Weissmans of Westport. Well, indeed, you explore love in various forms in the book, but I think the most moving portions are those where you are describing maternal love with such beautiful language. I have to tell you, I found myself holding my breath and then sighing after reading this passage when the character of Miranda, the younger sister, becomes entranced with her boyfriend's little boy. This passage: Henry kissed her wrist as it passed near his lips, the pressure so gentle, like a butterfly's wing, seemed to travel through her entire body. She took his free hand and held it against her cheek. This, she thought, is all there is, this little hand in mine. Oh, I thought about a day, I mean, this absolutely unremarkable day otherwise, when I was shopping with my son 22 years ago. He was four. And I just remember his taking my hand on an escalator. Hmm. And that made that moment indelible. And of course, you write about it much more elegantly here.
Well, I'm in a way, I'm glad I forgot my book, because you read it much more elegantly than I might have. I have two sons. They're grown now. They're in their 20s. But there are certain memories like that they just bring you up short when you think about them. And I really did want to capture that in both the immediate feelings that Miranda was having about little Henry, and also in the more distant reminders that Annie was having about with her two grown sons. But that is something I found great pleasure in writing about.
Well,
I'm glad you liked it.
I loved it, and like you, and I think we were born the same year. I also have two grown children, and the part near the very end where Annie is at a funeral with her sons. Annie held her sons in her arms, first Nick, then Charlie, and felt their broad, manly shoulders shake with sobs. She stroked their heads, her hands absorbing the shape, the warmth. How could she stop? She clung to them. During the funeral ceremony, she sat behind them, refusing to take her eyes off them. She remembered them as children, tiny children, asleep on the big bed in Betty's apartment, Charlie clutching his rabbit and a stale bagel, Nick in a basket. Betty sat upright between, looking first at one, then the other, for hours. You've written about New York, L.A., and other locations. Here it's Westport, Connecticut. How does a setting influence a narrative for you?
Well, I think it's, for me, it's very, very, very powerful. And places usually become a kind of, another character in whatever I'm writing. Certainly with Westport, which has actually shown up in a number of books that I've done, sometimes disguised with another name. But my first two books, I called it Westport. In The Love Letter, I called it Pequot. Mm-hmm. In The Evolution of Jane, I called it Barlow. It's not exactly Westport, but this book, it was something I had been thinking of. I really wanted to write about Westport, And so this gave me that opportunity. That's kind of one of the ways this book came together. There were certain things I was feeling this urge to do. One was to write about the love of the romances of older people and middle-aged people. And the other was to write about this town, which I haven't really lived in 40 years. And yet it has such a hold on my imagination. It's very, very different from when I grew up there. But there's something about it that it just exerted a certain power over me. And I just wanted to share that.
Place does seem to become a character in your books. And I think that's still another of the very attractive features of them. In The New Yorkers, I felt like Central Park and the little sidewalks, the streets. It was all very vivid. And I noticed in The Three Wisemans of Westport, it's in the desert where searing experiences occur. Was that very deliberate?
No, it was a kind of unconscious choice of I wanted a place that was outside of Westport, that was very, very different, that was a kind of vacation place. And I had been in the desert, fairly recently. But, a lot of times, with me at least, I do things unconsciously, and then afterward someone will point something out to me and I'll say, oh yeah, that must be why I did that. So I think that was actually a kind of unconscious choice. I wanted to, again, it was one of those places I'd been there, I'd seen all this, and I really thought it was a kind of wonderful setting and that it would work perfectly for this confrontation that takes place. And it seemed very funny and colorful, but then it in fact had, as you say, this whole other meaning to it, which I didn't really realize until after I'd done it.
You have a nice mixture of Yiddish expressions and very elegant language. I love this description of Miranda curled up in bed as she's so despondent, and you write about an arabesque of despair. And then you have Betty talking about how good kvetching is for the soul, and Cousin Lou's Yiddishism. It's I think it underscores that this very elegant family still is somewhat grounded and has not lost touch with where they came from. Is that why you've peppered some of this?
Yeah, I think so. And two things. One, I think that it's, again, something I wanted to explore, which is that secular Jews are still Jews, and this is not a book about being Jewish, but it is about Jewish people who live in the world. And I find that I've always kind of done that. Some years ago with a much earlier book, a friend of mine who's a very distinguished English professor, I had given him the manuscript to read, and he was very, very helpful. And then he said, but I don't understand. Why are they Jews? They don't have to be Jews. Why are they Jews? And I said, well, why not? Because, you don't have to be writing about, people eating pastrami sandwiches and telling jokes or going to shul or rebelling against being Jews in order to write about Jews. It's just a milieu that I know and where, there's a certain rhythm to the year that has to do with Jewish holidays mixed in with other holidays. That's the way I experience the world, and I think it's the way a lot of people do, and that's what I'm, kind of drawn to write about. And also because I do write about families, and that's the kind of family that I understand the best, where I can really, pick up the nuances and explore them in greater depth and of course make better jokes.
As the story unfolds and the family dynamics become more complicated and each of the three main characters undergoes crises, are Betty, Annie, and Miranda learning as much about each other as they are about themselves?
That's a good question. I think by the end of the book, I won't give away too much. But I think by the end of the book, they have learned something about one another, and something about themselves. But, you know, my feeling is that when people are presented with a crisis, one of the signs of real strength is not so much changing to adapt to the crisis, but managing to stay yourself as you adapt to the crisis. And I think to some extent, both Miranda and Annie and Betty manage to maintain their identities, who they really are, even as they have to kind of go with the flow of this huge change to all of their lives. And that's one of the things I like about them, that they don't, it's not that they grow and change and suddenly become these, people who understand everything and are no longer selfish and, you know, no longer shy or whatever it is that, you know, it's not that they have some huge awakening. It's that they survive and they stay themselves, even though they're now in completely different environments. And that's what I admire about them and about people in general.
Well, I think you've created characters whose presence will remain with readers who thoroughly appreciate the Three Wisemans. Kathleen Shine, this has been a joy. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
To learn more about the books and authors featured on Between the Lines, go to our website at wabe.org/BTL and listen to an archived program. Or check out our suggested reading list for both children and adults. To subscribe to a podcast of the program, go to our website and click on Podcast. Be sure to join us next week for another engaging program, because there's always more to learn when you go Between the Lines. The executive producer of this program is Lois Reitzes. Producer, Marjorie Lancer. Editor and technical producer, Mike Johns. Assistant producer, Colin Baylor. Opening and closing music by Afro Blue. And I'm your host, Valerie Jackson. Between the Lines is a production of 90.1 WABE.